This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacific Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and today we take a look at the consequences or meaning of the State of the Union address overnight by President Barack Obama. And in consideration of that, we will be, during today's program, speaking with Glenn Ford, the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. Also, we are about to go live now to Professor Thomas Ferguson, a political scientist at the University of Massachusetts and a fellow of the Roosevelt Institute. And Professor, you heard the speech last night. There are many elements to get into, economic, political, law enforcement and otherwise, international policy and marketing, industry and so on. But first, welcome to 5 o'clock shadow, and what are your most general impressions of the speech?
I'm glad to be here. I was underwhelmed. I mean, there was some intriguing stuff in there, of which the reference to a mortgage refinancing plan was, I think, the most momentous. You know, if they actually did that on a large scale, it would probably be a tremendous shot in the arm for the economy, probably better than almost anything you could do. But they have been talking about this for 3 years, and, you know, I could compile you an album of quotes from people who in the administration who said, well, we really get it, we're going to do something, and then nothing ever happens. So I'm sort of glad for the flourish of trumpets, but another mouse better not step out.
To paraphrase an old saying, was last night's speech the first day of his presidential campaign?
Well, I think he's been running for a while, but I get your drift. And, yes, I mean, that seems pretty obvious. You know, some of the other stuff I don't much care for at all. I have to tell you that I think if you, you know, he was on and on about exports and special tax breaks and subsidies for stuff. I think it would be much better if he simply refocused, you know, gave up all the business that he's been talking about for actually 2 years about trying to get the deficit down. In the next couple of years, that's not our problem. And instead, just tried to get the level of total demand in the economy up to the point where people could go back to work. You know, he just needs to emulate not Theodore, but Franklin Roosevelt a bit more. And, you know, he's clearly, I think, not going to do that. I mean, a lot of countries in this situation in past times have, where they have, you know, they're sitting in a structurally weak position, and so they start launching these special programs, and everybody competes like mad to get a few bucks. Much better to sort of solve the general problem, I think. I don't quarrel with government programs, especially for clean energy. It's pretty obvious that the total social costs of, you know, oil especially are very much higher than the price of the pump. So it makes sense from a social standpoint to sort of folks to get in there and try to do something. But, you know, whether any particular, I mean, the ethanol stuff in Iowa made no sense at all. You know, I mean, that was just silly. And there's an awful lot, you can get into an awful lot of bad programs, especially in a political system that's as thoroughly money-dominated as ours. And, you know, that's another point. The president's discussion of the money in politics problem was very superficial. Basically, the notion that, like, your problem is to tell your bundlers that they can't talk to Congress. I mean, come on. Bundlers need to be told they can't talk to the president and the executive branch. We're an awful lot of the public. I mean, that would impress me a little bit more. And, you know, it's not much of a trick to tell congressmen and women that they shouldn't be trading inside. You know, the rest of us already have to live with that forbidden action. But, you know, unless you do a ban on spouses and staff, it doesn't mean much. And in any case, it's not the essence of the problem. The essence of the problem is vast amounts of secret money in enormous quantity. The president just punted on that. The other thing I think I have to say here, I sort of feel obliged to do something, is I'm very unhappy about that joint federal-state tax task force to prosecute mortgage fraud. That's not because I don't want bankers who've done stuff that's illegal to get prosecuted. The issue is rather that, you know, the Attorney General Holder and his associates should not need any help to do that. They should be doing that for a long time, and of course they've done almost nothing. But it's the state's attorneys general that have been leading the way, some of them, and including Mr. Schneiderman in New York, on serious mortgage crackdowns. And you put those together with the feds, what's, I think, likely to happen is that the feds will slow them down. I see this as potentially making it much less likely that the vigorous state prosecution and investigations that have been going on is likely to be completed. I think it's a real problem. I don't think Mr. Schneiderman's serving the public interest by joining so readily with that, though I understand the incentives.
You raise a most important point about the money and the way that the bipartisan charade allows people to think that there is a difference when both parties are, most every member of Congress or executive elections, are so highly financed by PACs and corporations and members who give.
Yep.
To such an extent that, do you think that contributes to the indistinguishability between Democrats and Republicans when it comes to economic policy?
Yeah, I have to tell you that I take your point about, in a broad sense, for a lot of people, it doesn't make all that much difference. They're getting fleeced under both regimes. If you study it with a somewhat finer comb, as it were, a finer magnifying glass, you can see differences, and some of them are important. You know, I mean, I think the research that suggests that the Republicans basically keep raising, lowering taxes for the rich hugely and making the rich much richer than most of the time for Democrats, I think that's probably pretty good. There are some significant differences there, though, you know, I acknowledge the sort of exactly what you're pointing to. I mean, this is second-order stuff. It's not, I mean, what you've got is two, I mean, I've probably written more about this than anybody alive, and I was sort of into it long before it became fashionable, and we have two money-driven political parties in this country. They do, nevertheless, somewhat differ. I mean, if you look, you could characterize it on financial reform as the Democrats offered a weak package and the Republicans want none at all. That's, I think, a pretty fair statement of what Dodd-Frank, the so-called reform bill, actually did. And you can see how the Republicans in Congress have reacted even to that.
Well, on the economic front, one of the other issues that I'm aware of your considering is a complaint one hears quite often from those taking part in the Occupy movements across the country, and that is what... to many people would seem an indefinite indenture of students with usurious loans. What is your analysis of that and whether any good is being done on that front?
Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, it's nice to hear the president say he'd like to prevent a rise in interest rate for students, but the plain fact is you can't go on having students just borrow the entire cost of their college educations. I mean, you are exactly creating sort of modern system of debt peonage. Now, behind this sits the almost complete withering away of public education. It's at all levels, but especially in public higher ed, where the state role has probably fallen faster than any place else. It's ridiculous. You know, I mean, many state universities now collect less than half their revenues from the state. You know, that's a crazy situation. I mean, state support is just way down. Often what legislators do is they face with conflicting demands, they go for the big bucks, and the big bucks are mostly in health care. And so they spend the money on, you know, health-related stuff, and they let higher ed go. That's a, and you, our percentage, our relative ranking in the number of people going to higher ed has fallen a lot since the 1970s. It's become a kind of sick joke even in international comparisons. And you know, the president, nothing he said last night really addresses that problem. You know, and the broad problem of, especially when you're doing retraining and the pattern of subsidies and things like that he's talking to. A lot of that stuff is going to be administered by the states. A lot of the programs, nearly all of them in education, and for that matter, many health programs, they get channeled. If it's federal government money, it gets channeled through the states. Well, the states are flat on their back. Some are actually broke. And, you know, you're not going to be able to use the states effectively in these conditions. And, you know, the president didn't address that at all.
Professor Ferguson, you're a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute and political science and economic specialist. And one of the things that baffles me is how little discussion there is in the economic forums of the relation to international policy. And I'm not just talking about trade and embargoes and labor and job displacement. I'm talking about the tremendous multi-decatrillion dollar cost of the United States wars abroad. Do you think that there is a significant relationship between the economy and global warfare, and has that been sufficiently addressed?
No, it hasn't been sufficiently addressed. I have a piece on the budget that I did with Rob Johnson that's in the International Journal of Political Economy, and we tried to figure out, using some other people's research, Robert Higgs and Chalmers Johnson, you know, the amount of the budget that is actually spent on defense is substantially more than the stuff that's reported, simply the defense budget in most cases. I mean, my memory on this is it might run as high as 40%, close to 40% of the actual budget. There isn't nearly enough discussion of this, and I entirely agree that war spending, it's just the amount. I mean, if you just had, for the United States, the money that has been blown in Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, and it was incidentally a point, you know, the president, I thought, rather, was a little too swift to pat himself on the back. I'm glad the troops are out of Iraq, but, I mean, somebody needs to sort of meditate a touch on the fact that, you know, we spent a fortune. Several thousand Americans are dead, not to mention many more Iraqis. And there's basically nothing to show for that. I mean, you have a collapsing government over there that you didn't even get the sort of U.S. puppet regime that some of the Republicans who made the basic decisions to get in there were counting on. I mean, this is really a colossal failure, and you still have the problem in Afghanistan where the Pakistan problem is just enormous, and they don't seem to have any clue as to what to do about that. We spend, and I have my worries, too, about, you know, the new Pacific strategy. Now, I take some consolation from the fact that when the president, you know, flew out there and talked about it, he was going to put 500 Marines and then later some more out in Australia, I think it's fair to say that those guns are trained really not on China, as some of the Chinese reacted to, but they're really trained on Mitt Romney and other potential Republican candidates. That is to say, he's trying to look militarily tough. I mean, it's maybe, but you know, the notion that, for instance, that the U.S. can greatly improve its position by putting a lot of military forces in the Western Pacific is nuts. I mean, the fundamental issue there is the prodigious rate of Chinese growth vis-a-vis the now near dead flat pancake growth in the United States. What happens every year in those countries that the U.S. tries to impress with its military force is that, you know, another 5 or 7% of all the business groups in those countries get more oriented toward China. This has nothing to do with military strength. It's a losing hand, and we continue to play it.
One final question on the international front, and your assessment of the military cost and tactics is quite useful. And here in Iraq, there are the transfer of American troops to Kuwait right next door for a re-intervention. There is planned infinite presence in Afghanistan. I know that the administration has plans to be there at least through the year 2014, despite the promises of starting to withdraw. And the United Kingdom says they'll be there till 2015. On top of that...
Well, the French won't. It looks like they may be out in a month or two. Go ahead. I didn't mean to...
Well, they just have so little patience.
Yep.
And then on the political front... the Obama administration has engaged in a State Department-supported internet revolution, sort of a franchise of revolutions around the world in Northern Africa, and has resulted in as much as a 75% victory of Islamic fundamentalists in the so-called election process there, a thoroughly reactionary regime and racist regime has been installed in Libya. Is the United States beyond its depth when it tries to engage
in
these policies?
Beyond its depth, I'd say, however, they're also beyond their means. I would have to say that I don't think the North African revolutions or the Arab Spring was basically the U.S. didn't affect that. They were slow on the uptake. They were still trying to sort of down-pedal the Egyptian government's interference in those elections a year or so ago when it all hit. Now, their initial response, which was to prevent a massacre, I think was a very good one and constructive. I mean, I think in that stuff, the U.S. is going to have to accept the fact that it cannot dominate those regions. The time is past when you could just keep a regime going. I mean, in particular, the rise in food prices and the huge rates of unemployment that were really explosive. And that those conditions haven't disappeared, although I think there might be some slight improvement in some food prices in some countries. I mean, there's a lot of country variation despite a world price there too. So, yeah, my take on the North African stuff, I'm less down on the administration, though. I thought they got just an awful lot of luck, and there is frankly not much they can do to block Islamic fundamentalism. They will have to engage them and hope, that it works out. But I think the ability of the U.S. to control the situation in these countries is, it's disappearing. It's a relic of a past age. They will also have to face the same problem in the Persian Gulf pretty soon.
Well, that's where we're going to have to leave it, Professor Ferguson. Thomas Ferguson of the University of Massachusetts at Boston, a fellow of the Roosevelt Institute, and I thank you for a very sharp and insightful analysis today. We must talk again. Where can people follow your work?
I write a lot on the web sometimes, and I write a lot of academic stuff. I got a book called Golden Rule. Best thing to do, I think, is Google it. But I have to tell you, I don't think, it's not like I'm telling you read my work and everything gets clear or the world gets saved. I think we're well past that point. It's not about me.
Well, certainly the insights that you've brought are of great value, and I appreciate that. And thank you for joining us today.
Pleasure.
On 5 O'Clock Shadow, Professor Thomas Ferguson. My name is Robert Knight, and we will continue with our assessment of the State of the Union, and we'll be coming back in just a moment with Glenn Ford, the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report, as we, during this age of Obama, consider the prospects for genuine change.
It's been a long change gonna come. Oh, yes it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long coming, but I know
is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and our guest is the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. Glenn Ford now joins us. And Glenn, have you been considering the State of the Union address by President Barack Obama last night?
Well, what we do compels us to watch whatever he does, and especially the State of the Union once a year. So certainly we've written about it. It's in today's issue of Black Agenda Report. It's called State of Obama, Immunity for Wall Street.
Black Agenda Report, for those who have not yet looked at the analysis there, tell them what you do there.
Well, as our masthead says, we're commentary, news, and analysis from the Black left. Well, we are coming from the Black left, and we're journalists, so you'll get that kind of product from us, and I don't think you get it too many other places.
Well, let's just have some of that. What were your reactions? Were there encouraging moments or disappointments or some combination of the speech?
Well, we don't get disappointed at Barack Obama. We haven't been disappointed with him in a very, very long time because we've known him for a very long time. Our team has been studying Barack Obama and interacting with him on occasion since the summer of 2003, when his name first came up on the Democratic Leadership Council's membership list. The DLC, of course, is the right wing of the Democratic Party, the corporate money bag of that party, and his name turned up on its membership list, and we interrogated him on that. It's also the same week that he took his now famous October 2002 anti-war speech off of his campaign website. He was running for the Democratic senatorial nomination in Illinois at the time. So we had him figured out. We certainly had him figured out after his national debut at the Democratic National Convention in 2004 when he said there is no Black America, there is only the United States of America, and we've been critical of him ever since. So he does not disappoint us. We have recognized him as another corporate right-of-center Democrat for a very long time.
And yet there are those who consider him to be a progressive, pro-Black, pro-poverty president. What discrepancies did you find in the speech that did not live up to those perceptions?
When he was talking about the economy, and as I wrote in our article, his little tax tinkering schemes could have been come up with by any number of Republican moderates of a generation ago. Of course, Republican moderates no longer exist. Their counterparts exist as center-right Democrats. And those are the formulas that Barack Obama put forward. What was clearly the most newsworthy State of the Union address involved this new investigative unit that he announced to investigate banker misdoings surrounding people mortgages and the foreclosure of people's homes. I don't think the public understands what that story really represents. For many months now, a group of state attorney generals have been trying to conduct their own investigations into the robo-signing practices of banks and the illegal foreclosures that results from that automated securitization process for mortgages. Those suits threaten to go to the very legal foundations of how the American banking system now works, has worked since President Clinton deregulated banking in his last years in office. President Obama has been doing his damnedest to push through a settlement of that situation that would give the banks immunity from prosecution from all the crimes that they've committed against homeowners and the American public in general before and since the meltdown of 2008. He's put tremendous pressures on those attorney generals to drop their investigations and allow a paltry $25 billion settlement to consumers. $25 billion is nothing compared to the trillions of dollars in vanished home values that people have suffered. But a number of the attorneys general persisted. They didn't buckle under to the president. The president thought that he was going to be able to make an announcement of this settlement, one that he would couch as a benefit that he brought to consumers, even though a coalition of labor and consumer organizations and Move On had been agitating in support of the attorneys general. But when he couldn't get that settlement that would declare the bankers immune from prosecution, essentially, then he was forced to make a compromise at the last minute, happened just yesterday, and announced that there would be a special federal investigative unit to do what the federal government should have been doing but refused to do all along, and that is look into these banking practices. Now, that was the newsworthy event that happened yesterday. Everything else was just a rehash of old Obama policies that, as I said, could have been moderate Republican policies of some decades ago.
Glenn Ford, the mortgage crisis and the escalating interest rates has been a tremendous burden to particularly black people, but Latinos and other people of poverty as well. And in addition to that, there is the unemployment crisis that disproportionately affects people of color. Were there any useful recommendations or actions by Obama on that front? Or does the code language of fiscal reform mean that people of poverty may be facing even more federal retrenchments?
Yes, Obama's an austerity president. He has outbid the Republicans on some occasions last year in terms of his willingness to cut the budget, that is, to cut the people's portions of the budget. In terms of black folks, count the words. He said the word black once yesterday, and he was referring there to black soldiers and other minority people in the armed forces. That was his mention of the word black. Black unemployment, of course, went up when other people's unemployment was going down. That did not deserve a mention. His suggestions, and that's all they are, on job creation really echo his previous suggestions, using as a model the Georgia Works program, which was found to be just basically a giveaway to companies to pay to get cheaper labor from people who they didn't train. And in the end, the state of Georgia dropped the program. That was the model that Obama was touting last year. This year, he has these misty, murky outline of a plan to do it on a much larger basis with a lot more companies providing supposedly training. Probably if he's true to form, just more subsidies for these corporations so that their effective cost of workers is a fraction and the public picks up the tab and no real new jobs would be created. These corporations do not create jobs because of tax incentives. They create jobs because of demand for product. And if there's no demand for product because people aren't making enough money or any money, then the recession in terms of consumer spending will continue. No tax tinkering can solve that. And people have short memories. In 2008, in the first month of 2008, when there were three candidates still standing, Hillary Clinton, the gentleman from North Carolina, and John Edwards, and Barack Obama, the mortgage, the home foreclosure crisis was then becoming quite an issue. Of the three, only Barack Obama opposed even a voluntary moratorium on foreclosures or a voluntary moratorium on the hiking of interest rates. Even Hillary Clinton was for a voluntary moratorium on both, and John Edwards wanted a mandatory moratorium on both foreclosures and rising interest rates. So Obama has been consistent. You asked if we were disappointed in him. We're not, because he's been consistent. He has opposed anything that would mess with market forces. Market forces meaning let the banks and the other corporations do as they wish. So we're not disappointed that he didn't provide any real relief in that regard. He's true to form. We expected as much.
Like Stevie Wonder, you're much amazed but not amused.
Ain't nothing funny about this.
Our guest is Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report. And Glenn, I'd like to go on the international front now, in particular with regard to the Obama Africa policy. Here we stand in the aftermath of what reasonable minds might construe as the reimposition of apartheid in Northern Africa with the overthrow of the Libyan government and the unleashing of the racism of the Cyrenaicans that are now rounding up thousands and perhaps tens of thousands of Afro-Libyans and corralling them with no legal or judicial redress. We have U.S. Military bases in Djibouti, where clandestine operations and drone attacks are being based from. There are U.S. troops now being sent to South Sudan and Uganda, and a growing hot war in Somalia. What is your assessment of the first Black American president's policy for Africa?
President Obama was always among the staunchest supporters of AFRICOM, the U.S. Africa Command. AFRICOM's first big war was, of course, the six-month bombardment of Libya. And they were quite proud of it. They flexed their muscles. They tested new weapons. They got their command and control procedures in order. And that prepared them for new and thrilling adventures, which Barack Obama promptly set them off, which, as you mentioned, is the sending of special forces to Central Africa. These are infrastructural maneuvers that have already set Africa aflame. Now, Barack Obama claimed that he was not at war in Libya because Americans, at least none that we know, were killed. In other words, the Obama doctrine is we can bomb the hell out of anybody that we want, but if we don't suffer casualties, it's not a war, and therefore I don't even have to report to Congress. Really, that is a new doctrine that our first Black president can lay claim to. But what the United States has been putting together, and Obama has accelerated the process in Africa, is to stage overlapping proxy wars to achieve U.S. objectives. And so we have in Somalia the U.S. proxies Kenya, which has not had a war with anybody except some dust-ups among its own people, its own Somalis, hasn't had a war with anyone since independence. But there, at U.S. instigation and being paid for the privilege, they're at war in Somalia. Ethiopia acts as a U.S. proxy in Somalia. Djibouti, that enclave, basically a French colony and an American base, it now has troops in Somalia. And the African Union has been bullied into putting its banner over U.S.-paid troops from Burundi and Uganda, who have been the only thing that's propped up this puppet regime installed basically by the United States in Mogadishu. So all of these Black actors are playing out their roles while the United States pulls the strings and pays the cost, and that's just in the Horn of Africa. Now that same scenario was going to play out in Central Africa around South Sudan, the new nation that will be inaugurated onto the world stage as a base of U.S. operations and a pawn in the U.S. game. Uganda will continue to play its mercenary role. That is, it's willing to send soldiers anywhere for U.S. purposes on the continent. The same with Rwanda. The U.S. gets its little minions together, and then it finances and plans and does diplomatic cover for these proxy wars that are really in pursuit of U.S. interests, and especially in Africa, in pursuit of U.S. corporate mineral extracting interests. And that war is on. But, of course, Obama doesn't have to admit to waging war because, as far as we know, Americans aren't being killed, just a whole bunch of Africans.
Glenn Ford, final question. If the Obama administration, and for that matter, perhaps the entire congressional industrial complex, is not concerned about redress of racial differentials or the service of people of poverty, is there any possibility that you see in a pan-constituency movement? Of course, the Occupy movement comes to mind, but how does one marshal sufficient force to alter the policies that seem intent upon trampling those who are perceived as powerless?
Well, as long as this black president is in office, the progressive movement in the United States, which has never been that strong, the progressive movement will operate under distinct disadvantages, which is a soft way of saying will be crippled, and crippled by the black absence. You know, every 5 years or so over my long career, I've tried to figure out what percentage of the population could reasonably be considered progressive. And you use different criteria at different times, but the calculations always result in a figure around 20%, that about one out of five Americans could reasonably be considered progressive. And it's always the same. Half of those are black. So at the heart of any movement that for progressive transformational change in the United States, black folks have to be there. And if they are neutralized by the mere presence of a black person in the White House, then that movement is vastly weakened. But there are promising signs, and the Occupy Wall Street movement has changed the conversation. And it is an amazing thing that following on the heels of a summer in which all the talk was about austerity and debt and austerity, now the conversation is about income inequality and corporate domination and the injustice of that. So already we've seen a change. Our folks, black folks, are carrying the weight of this first black president. It's a new experience, and we haven't, we're not taking it very well.
Glenn Ford is the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report, online at blackagendareport.com, where you can find his latest analyses and those of his colleagues as well. And Glenn, thank you so much for joining us today on 5 O'Clock Shadow.
Thank you so much for the privilege.
It's not too cool to be
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. We welcome your comments and queries with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. With engineering by Michael G. Haskins and Reggie Johnson of Pacifica Station WBAI, I'm Robert Knight in New York for 5 O'Clock Shadow.